This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, RC45599, Pearls of Lutra by Brian Jakes, illustrated by Alan Curlis. Text copyright 1996 by Brian Jakes. Read by David Palmer. This book contains 408 pages on 9 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player and fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the table of contents, or at the second beep to locate the beginning of the book. Library of Congress Annotation. Redwall Abbey has a hidden treasure of 6 large pink pearls. Tansy, the hedgehog maid, is determined to find them, but so is Emperor Ublaz, who had stolen them years before from the otters of Holt Lutra. Meanwhile, Martin the warrior attempts to rescue the kidnapped abbot, Durrell. Companion to Redwall, RC29729, for grades 5 through 8, 1996. From the book jacket. The tears of all oceans are missing. 6 magnificent rose-colored pearls that inspire passion and greed in all who see them. They have left a cryptic trail of death and deception in their wake. And now Ublaz, Mad Eyes, the evil emperor of a tropical isle beyond where the sun sets, is determined to let no one stand in the way of his desperate attempt to claim the pearls as his own. At Redwall Abbey, a young hedgehog maid, Tansy, is determined to find the pearls first, with the help of her friends. Each of the pearls is hidden separately, along with a riddle as to the whereabouts of the next. Tansy must succeed, as the life of one she holds dear is in great danger. Meanwhile, the crew of fearsome monitor lizards and corsairs, gathered by Ublaz, grows restless. Empowered by great mystery and swashbuckling adventure, Brian Jakes's newest saga from Redwall is at once his most intriguing and his most entertaining yet. Enjoy the journey. About the author. Brian Jakes has been telling stories for as long as people have been willing to listen. He has performed as a dramatist, comedian, folk singer, and radio show host. But it is as the creator of the Redwall Tales that he has gained international acclaim. Entertaining and enchanting readers in Europe, the United States, and the Far East. The response of American readers to the Redwall series has been unprecedented. Since the publication of his first novel, Redwall, in 1987, Brian's popularity has increased with each new story. And despite the fact that he maintains his home in England, he is a frequent visitor to classrooms, bookstores, and libraries across the United States. Pearls of Lutra is the 9th novel in the Redwall series, which has also given rise to Brian Jakes's first storybook, The Great Redwall Feast, illustrated by Christopher Denise. Other books by Brian Jakes. Mossflower, Matameo, Mariel of Redwall, Salamandastron, Martin the Warrior, The Bellmaker, Outcast of Redwall, 7 Strange and Ghostly Tales. Book 1, 6 Tears for an Abbot, Side 1. Book 2, Westward the Warriors, Side 3. Book 3, When Tears Are Shed, Side 6. Reader's Note: The map found in the print edition is not included in this recording. End of note. O curse the name Mad Eyes, say woe to the day when he tried to steal tears of all oceans away. All corsairs and sea rats, whose messmates lie dead, saw blood and hot flame turn the seas flowing red. Though North Coast lies far and the ocean is wide, run from the green arrows of vengeance and hide. For the price of 6 tears, through the dreams of us all, walks the fear of a warrior from the place called Redwall. Now the life of our brethren, who followed the sea, will ne'er be the same for such rovers as we. 'Twas the greed of a tyrant that brought us to shame. 6 tears for a crown. Curse the emperor's name. Verses taken from an old corsair ballad. Book 1, 6 Tears for an Abbot. 1. Though Tansy was still only a young hedgehog, she was known to be a veritable rock of good sense by the elders of Redwall Abbey. Because of this, she was one of the few youngsters allowed outside the abbey walls, mainly to gather materials for Sister Cicely's remedies. Fine spring sunshine, tinged light green from the semi-transparent new leaves, filtered down through the high canopy of mossflower wood, and somewhere off deeper in the woodlands a cuckoo sang its repetitive aria to the growing season. Tansy put her basket down upon a mossy knoll and began setting out food, a little chunk of yellow cheese, small farls of soft nut bread, a few candied chestnuts, and a flagon of elderberry cordial. Fussily she dusted out the insides of two wooden beakers with her apron, then she peered about at the surrounding tree trunks.
"I know you're there, Arvin. Now come out this instant, or I'll eat all this lunch, and you won't get a crumb," she called.
The tiny squirrel leapt from a nearby elm, landing neatly in a sitting position, right next to her. Tansy stifled her surprise at his sudden appearance, and busied herself unfolding two clean serviettes, as she lectured her charge severely.
"What have you been told about wandering off? Do you know I'm responsible for you? Just look at those mucky paws. Wipe them off on the moss before you touch a single thing, you maggot."
Arvin scrubbed his little paws on the clean linen smock he wore, leaving two muddy patches across it. He smiled winningly and grabbed a candied chestnut.
"Am never wandled off. No need to be responsible for Arvin. Not getting lost. Oh, no, too starvin' to be losted."
Tansy tried to hide a smile, but found herself unable to. Chuckling, she poured out a beaker of cordial for her friend.
"You're a little maggot. What are you?" "Me a little starvin' maggot. He-he-he. But Arvin eat all lunch, then me be big maggot, and go ho-ho-ho."
The little squirrel was never still. As he ate and drank, he hopped around the knoll, chanting,
"Miggity maggity ho ho ho, tansy pansy toogle doo.
I'll tansy pansy you if you make yourself sick jumping around while you're eating,"
Tansy muttered, more to herself than Arvin, as she checked over the plants she had collected.
Old hogweed stalks, young angelica shoots. Let's see, what else did Sister Cicely want? Wintergreen. There may be some by the rocks."
She glanced up at the sky. It had been gradually clouding over as they ate, and now a few telltale drops on her face caused the young hedgehog to tut with annoyance.
"Titch, titch, rain. There was no sign of it earlier. Sky was clear as a bell. Come on, Arvin, help me to pack this lot back into the basket. You can finish your lunch while I search among the rocks. There's good shelter there."
Swiftly the two friends repacked their basket and set off east, deeper into the woodlands. A chill wind sprang up, buffeting the treetops, whipping the increasing downpour until rain found its way through and began thrumming against the loamy earth. Tansy shielded Arvin with her cape as he railed against the unpredictable mid-spring weather.
"First a sunny, then a rainy wet. It's a maggot."
The rocks were dark red sandstone ledges, tilted at a crazy angle in a small scrubby clearing. They pushed up out of the ground, piled against each other like a row of books gone askew on a bookshelf. Gaps caused by erosion formed many small, shallow caves, and Tansy and Arvin huddled under the nearest one as the wind chased the rain. Arvin went into a little dance, shaking himself vigorously. Tansy shielded her face by holding up the basket.
"Be still, you rogue!
I'm quite wet enough without you splashing rain all over me. Oh, look, wintergreen!"
Reaching out into the rain, she plucked a tiny plant with pale green spear-shaped leaves. Arvin was more interested in warmth.
"Light a fire, Tansy. Make Arvin dry and warm," he whimpered.
Tansy studied the strong-smelling seedling, which had been crushed under paw by them as they entered the cave, explaining to the little squirrel as she did,
"I don't have flints or tinder with me. Besides, old Rollo the recorder says that only grown and experienced beasts are allowed to light fires in the woodlands. Fire is a very dangerous thing if it gets out of control."
Arvin was not impressed by old Rollo's words.
"Fire very dangerful, cuff war," he said as he hopped out into the rain. "Anyhow, Arvin wet now. Can't get more wetted. Me gonna play.
He bounded off out of view, with Tansy calling after him. Stay close to the rocks, do you hear me? Don't go wandering off, and keep that new smock in one piece, or Mother Alma will tan your tail good and proper. When Arvin was out of sight, Tansy sat miserably, watching the rain pattering off the rocks, and staring at the ground in search of other wintergreen shoots. The day out that she had planned for herself and Arvin and Mossflower Woodlands had been ruined by the rain. It wasn't fair, especially after she had begged and pleaded with Alma to be allowed to take Arvin with her. The morning had started off bright and sunny. She had made up the lunch and packed it herself, listened carefully to Sister Cicely's instructions, then set off holding Arvin with one paw and the basket with the other, feeling very grown up and responsible. Wilger, the otter, was on gate duty, and he had winked and tipped his tail to Tansy as he let her out of the main wall gate. She smiled to herself, remembering how Viola Bankvoll had been watching from the rampart steps. That snippy Viola, mincing about and giving herself all kinds of airs and graces, always making smart remarks. But Viola was too flibbertigibbet to be allowed out alone. The young hedgehog had made a special point of waving at her and calling aloud, "Just popping out to Mossflower. See you later, Viola dear." The prissy Bankvoll had turned nearly purple with envy. Ha! That had shown her.
"Tansy!"
Arvin's scream brought Tansy back to the present like lightning. Tossing aside the basket, she hitched up her smock and went dashing out into the rain, scrambling up the rocks as she charged forward to the sounds of the screeching babe.
"Tansy! Hurry!"
Hurtling along the uneven top of the sloping sandstone mass, Tansy yelled into the wind and rain.
"Arvin, where are you? Keep shouting! Keep shouting!"
"Fell down her hole! Help! Tansy!"
Speeding to the spot where the sound came from, Tansy threw herself on all fours, reaching her paws down into a broad crack in the rocks. She felt Arvin's tiny damp paws latch onto hers and breathed a swift sigh of relief.
"Hold tight! I'll have you out of there in a tick!"
Before she could start lifting him, the nimble little fellow had scrambled up over her paws, stepped on her nose, and onto the back of her neck, leaping clear and shouting,
"Looka, looka, down there! Yee!"
Lying face down, Tansy gazed into the rift. With a gasp of horror, she found herself staring into the eyeless sockets of a skull, gap-toothed and grinning, with rain pattering on it to produce the most dreadful hollow sound. It stared back at her. Bleached bones and the ragged remnants of clothing clinging to them comprised the remainder of the skeleton, trapped in the jaws of the narrow rift. Thunder rumbled as a vivid flash of lightning lit up the stark scene. A scream of terror tore itself from the hedgehog maid's throat. Forgetting plants, basket, and picnic lunch, heedless of pelting rain and wind, Tansy grabbed Arvin's tiny paw. Together they leapt from the sandstone rocks, rolling, stumbling, and bounding down onto the wet grass. Both creatures sped off, as if the skeleton had risen from the rift to pursue them. Blindly they rushed through the storm-lashed woodland, footpaws slapping the ground, hearts racing madly, as they sought the path back to the warmth, peace, and safety of their home, Redwall Abbey. 2. Far across the heaving deeps of restless ocean, some say even beyond the place where the sun sinks in the west, there lies the Isle of Sampetra. At first sight, it's a lush tropical jewel set in turquoise waters where seasons never change from eternal summer. But a closer look reveals that Sampetra is rotten as a fly-blown fish carcass. It is a crossroads of evil, haven to the flotsam of the high seas. Corsairs, sea rats, and all manner of vermin sea scum make their birth at Sampetra, the domain of a pine marten, the mighty emperor, Ublaz. He is also known as Mad Eyes, though none ever called him that to his face and lived. He dwells in a palace built on a flat-topped escarpment at the island's southwesterly tip. Any ship entering the harbor must pay tribute to Ublaz, and captains who do not choose to anchor at Sampetra are considered to be foes of the emperor. It is his decree that their ships and even their lives are forfeit. They are fair game to his followers. Mad Eyes is cunning, all-powerful. Like a spider at the center of a great web, he rules Sampetra. No trees grow upon the island,
but Ublas has a vast timber stock in his courtyard. Wood for ship repairs is given only to those who pay him heavy tribute. The island is a good place for vermin from the seas to rest and royster. There are taverns dotted about the harbor area. Ublas is served by a regiment of rats who carry long tridents as a mark of their rank. His trident rats patrol the harbor night and day. However, the most fearsome of his creatures are great flesh-eating lizards known as the Monitors, who have inhabited San Petra for as long as any beast can remember. Only the mad-eyed emperor can control the dreadful reptiles with the power of his hypnotic stare. Conva, the corsair captain, was not a happy stoat as he watched his steer's rat bring their craft, the vessel Waveworm, into the bay of San Petra after many long seasons at sea. On the jetty, Conva could see lizards and trident rats waiting, and he knew what they were there for, to take him before the emperor. Had the corsair known any pleas or prayers to the fates, he would have said them right then, hoping that Mad-Eyes might have forgotten the treasure called Tears of All Oceans. But then he recalled his meeting with Ublas before the voyage, and the eyes, the strange mad eyes that had compelled him to return. Sounds of singing, fighting, and feasting drifted up from the taverns by the jetty as Waveworm hove alongside. Conva was relieved of his curved scimitar and marched off between two monitors and two trident rats. The remainder of the guards boarded the ship to make sure the crew stayed in their quarters until they received permission to come ashore. As he was ushered into the throne room of the emperor, Conva glanced around. It was the peak of barbaric splendor. There were silks, marble, rich velvet cushions, and satin hangings, and the air was heavy with the scent of strange aromatic herbs smoldering in wall braziers. The emperor was seated on a great carved cedar throne. Though Conva feared Ublas, he could not help but admire him. A big creature, this pine marten, strong, handsome, and sleek, with fine brown fur from head to bushy tail, complemented by a creamy yellow throat and ears. He was clad in a green silk robe with a gold border. Blue sapphires twinkled from the handle of a slim silver-bladed dagger thrust into a belt of shark skin. The face of Ublas was immobile. Savage white teeth showed slightly through a thin, almost lipless mouth, and above the curled, perfumed whiskers and light brown nose tip, two jet-black almond-shaped eyes stared at the corsair captain. All was quiet. Conva stood riveted by the eyes. They pierced him to the core. Silent and mysterious, Ublas sat, transfixing the corsair with his gaze until words began flowing from the hypnotized captain. "Mighty one who knows all, your commands were carried out. We raided the den of Lutra the Otter on the far north shores. They were taken by ambush and slain, every one of them, and all that they possessed was loaded aboard my ship." For the first time, Ublas spoke, his voice scarce above a whisper. "Tell me what you took. Everything." The corsair recited a list of spoils. "Beakers set with colored stones, platters also, carved bone, tail, and paw rings, one gold neckband, a box of small purple pearls, and another box made from a hinged scallop shell. This shell contained six large, rose-colored pearls." The emperor drew in his breath sharply. "The Tears of All Oceans, you have them." Conva began to shiver visibly. He collapsed to the marble floor, his voice trembling with fear.
"Mighty one, they were stolen."
Ublas sighed deeply, slumping back on his throne as if the bad news came as no surprise to him. "Tell me how this thing happened." Two monitors entered the throne room, bearing a litter containing the booty from Conva's ship, Waveworm. At a nod from Ublas, they set it down in front of him. The corsair continued his narrative in broken tones. "Two moons after we slew the tribe of Lutra, I charted a course following the coast south. I knew a stream of fresh water runs out across the beach near an area named Mossflower. We dropped anchor there and took on fresh water. When Waveworm was ready to get under sail again, two of my crew, both weasels, Flarenose and Greylunk, were discovered missing. So were the rose pearls and the scallop shell. They'd stolen them and jumped ship. I gave chase, tracked them, leaving behind only three to guard the ship. We found Flare Nose wounded some 3 days later. They had quarreled over the pearls, and Greylunk had stabbed him. We searched Flare Nose. He had no pearls, though before he died he told us that he'd given Greylunk a bad skull wound when they fought. 2 days on, following Greylunk's trail, we came upon a big building called Redwall Abbey. I had my crew scout around it in a wide circle, but the only track of Greylunk we could find went straight to the main door. This Redwall is a large, well-fortified place, with many creatures living there. We did not let them see us. Their numbers were 10 score more than ours. Greylunk is inside Redwall with the pearls. Or if he has died from his wound, then the pearls are still within the walls of that abbey. I could do no more, Mighty One, not with the numbers I had. I made it back to my ship with all speed, and hastened here to bring you the news. Ublaz moved smoothly around the booty on the litter, shifting through it with his silver-bladed dagger. Dented beakers, bone tail rings, gold neckband, huh? More like brass, he said to himself. Small purple pearls, worthless mussel seeds. Except for the rose pearls, the tribe of Lutra had nothing of value. They were poor as beggars. He ceased his examination and stood over the quaking corsair. And you, bold Kanva, what shall I do with you? The Emperor's fearsome eyes bored into Kanva's mind. His spirit completely broken with terror, the corsair groveled shamelessly at the Emperor's footpaws. Mighty One, Great Emperor, spare me. I will gather more crew and the help of other captains. Give me a chance, and I will go to Redwall and bring back the Tears of All Oceans. Ublaz stepped hard on the back of Kanva's neck, trapping his head against the floor. Scum of the sea! Fool who cannot control his own crew, the Pine Marten said, his voice dripping with contempt. Do you think I would let an idiot like you travel halfway round the world to fight a war against Redwall Abbey? I have heard of that place. The bones of warlords molder at its gates. More than one has tried to breach those red walls and died miserably. If I am to retrieve the Tears of All Oceans, it needs cunning strategy. Ublaz pointed his dagger at a trident rat guard. You, go and fetch my monitor general. Leaning down, the Pine Marten nicked Kanva's ear with his dagger. You I will let live until I know the truth of your story. Take him away and billet him in the monitor barracks. Kanva knew it was pointless to beg for mercy. He had escaped instant death. But how long would he survive unarmed in the barracks of the strange flesh-eating lizards? He was led off, stunned, almost speechless with terror. Lask Frildur, the monitor general, stood before the Emperor, flat reptilian eyes unblinking, scales making a dry rustle as his heavy spiked tail swished lazily against the marble floor. Ublaz nodded approvingly. The monitor general had never let him down. Every beast on Sampetra knew and feared the reputation of Lask Frildur. "Does all go well with you, my strong right claw?" Ublaz said, as he poured wine for them both. The Emperor turned his head from Lask's foul breath as the lizard answered. "Yar, mighty Nez, Lask Frildur awaits your orders." The mad-eyed Martin took a sip of wine and wiped his mouth fastidiously on a silk kerchief. "Good. I want you to take the ship of Kanva and carry out an important mission for me." The Monitor General's eyes flickered momentarily. "I will go the ends of oceans if Ublaz commands." He accepted the goblet of wine that was pushed towards him, holding it at throat height. Lask never let his eyes stray from those of Ublaz. His head did not dip to the goblet. Instead, a long tongue snaked out and lapped at the wine, as the Emperor gave his instructions. "It is a long voyage to where the sun rises in the east, a place called the Land of Mossflower. Take the Waveworm and her crew, with Romska the Ferret as captain, and a score of your monitors. Here is what you must do." Outside, the surf boomed on the sun-warmed rocks of the escarpment. and ships bobbed at anchor in the harbor. San Petra shimmered under the midday sun, a once beautiful jewel of the oceans, now tainted by the evil of its ruler. 3. Sagatar Sawfang was bigger than most sea rats, lean and sinewy, with a mean disposition. She was second only to Lask Krildur, the monitor general. Sagatar had fought her way up through the ranks of the Emperor's Trident Rats, until she held the undisputed title of Chief Trident Rat. Whilst the rats under her command patrolled San Petra's harbor and taverns, keeping order among the sea vermin, Sagatar leaned on a jetty stanchion, watching Waveworm grow small on the eastern horizon, bound for Mossflower. Grasping her trident haft resolutely, she allowed herself a grim smile of satisfaction. Now she alone was the strong right paw of Ublas, solely responsible for discipline among the wave scum who anchored at San Petra. Fate, however, is a cruel trickster. Turning her face west, Sagatar saw her happiness would be short-lived. The chief trident rat knew the identity of the bark sailing in from the western ocean. No other vessel flew streaming red pennants from three mastheads. It had to be the freebooter. She wrapped the three-pronged metal head of her trident against the jetty timbers until a trident rat came running to her summons. "Tell the full squad to muster on this jetty immediately." Lifting his trident smartly in salute, the rat hurried off. Few ships that sailed into San Petra had a master with a reputation for danger like Barranca, captain of the freebooter. Scorning pawholes, he balanced perfectly, high on the heaving prow, reckless and daring. Barranca was every inch a real swashbuckler, clad in flame-red silks with a long saber thrust into his broad black garnet-studded belt. Loose ends of the corsair stoat's headband fluttered in the breeze as he pointed shoreward, calling out to his steer's rat, "Ahar, see, Guja? 'Tis old Sourpuss Sagatar, and a welcoming committee awaiting us. Let's not disappoint him." Swinging nimbly to the deck, Barranca whipped out his saber and began roaring orders to Freebooter's crew. "All paws on deck, and arm yourselves to the teeth, mates!" The vessel's crew were a villainous and motley collection, mainly sea rats, but with a scattering of ferrets, stoats, and weasels. They fairly bristled with an array of cutlasses, daggers, and axes. Barranca drew his weasel mate Blowfly to one side. "Don't stand any old nonsense off in Mad-Eye's creatures, you hear?" Blowfly produced a broad curved knife, showing his blackened teeth. He licked the blade meaningfully, and said, "Aye, aye, Cap'n. We'll show 'em they can't push freebooters buckos round. Just you give the word." "Dangerous, matey. We're dangerous." The corsair tossed his saber high in the air, catching it skillfully as the blade flashed downward. "Ahar! You watch me tweak Sagatar's tail. I've never liked the cut of that pompous rat's jib, and she don't like me. So there ain't no love lost atwixt us." 20 trident rats stood to rigid attention on the jetty. Grim-faced, Sagatar watched Freebooter heave starboard side onto the pier and make fast to it. Barranca's loud, insulting challenge hailed her. "Ahoy, misery guts! Where's Frildur and his lizards today?" Sagatar pointed her trident menacingly at the grinning corsair. "Lask Frildur is the least of your worries. I'm the one who'll be dealing with you and your rabble, if there's any trouble." Barranca leapt up, straddling the jetty and ship's rail. "You don't say. Where's our old mate, the Monitor General, then? Done us all a favor and died, I hope. Har, har, har." Sagatar allowed herself a thin, malicious smile. "Not at all. Lask is still very much alive, sailing for the Mossflower coast on Waveworm at this very moment." Barranca turned and winked at Blowfly. "Ho, ho, is he? I'll wager me brother Conva ain't too pleased about that, eh, mate? Havin' that scaly old reptile aboard as a passenger?" Sagatar did not attempt to conceal the pleasure in her voice. "Your brother Conva is no longer captain of the Waveworm. He is now a prisoner of Emperor Ublas and is kept in the monitor barracks. I'll give him your best regards when I see him." "Right. Let's see what you've got on board in the way of tribute." Barranca blocked the chief trident rat's path aboard, his eyes fierce with challenge. "Put one paw aboard of my ship, rat, and I'll gut you. Crew, stand by to repel boarders. Freebooter's crew crowded the starboard rail, weapons ready for use against the trident rats. Baronka's gleaming saber tip hovered close to Sagatar's throat. She gulped visibly.
I warn you, this is the command of Emperor Ublaz you are defying.
The corsair did not back down a fraction.
No, it ain't. This is one of your fancy ideas. The tribute for Ublaz will be unloaded onto this jetty by my crew. You can come back tomorrow and collect it. Now shift yourself, rat.
Sagatar knew she had lost the argument. Drawing back, she marshaled her command, calling aloud to Baronka as they marched off.
I'll report this to the Emperor. He will hear of your defiance.
The derisive reply stung her as she left the jetty.
Report what you're like, rat nose. Ublaz knows my ship always brings the best booty to him, and he trusts me to unload it.
Word of Baronka's arrival ran like wildfire around the harbor. He was popular and well-liked by all the pirates on San Petra. Grog was broken out for all sea rat and corsair captains who met with Baronka aboard his ship. Having heard from them of his brother's arrest and imprisonment, he addressed them fiercely.
Who does Mad Eyes think he is, to lord it over us, mates? That Pine Martin was only a corsair like ourselves, who chanced to find this island first. Now he takes the best of our plunder, makes us live by some fancy set of rules he invented, and kills or imprisons who he likes. It ain't right, I tell you.
A grizzled sea rat captain called Slashback answered,
Aye, messmate, but Ublaz has trident rats and monitors to do his bidden. They enforce the laws round here.
Baronka whacked the flat of his saber blade down on the table.
I remember when sea beasts were free, and the only rules we had were our own. Now look at us. What have we come to, mates?
A tall, somber weasel captain called Bilgetail shrugged.
No one can stand against Mad Eyes and his army.
Baronka looked around the assembly.
You, Slashback, and you, Rockpaw, Bloodsnout, Ripdog, Flaney. You're all captains. You command crews.
By my reckoning, we must outnumber lizards and trident rats 2-1. Think of that. And here's another thing. Lask Frildor ain't here no more.
Who knows if an eel ever make it back?
Aye, and a score of monitors gone with him, too. If ever there was a right time for us to take over this island, it's now. There was a moment's silence. Then Ripdog, the weasel, stood alongside Baronka and voiced her opinion.
I'm with you, mate. Our lives ain't our own since we've been docking at San Petra. That Pine Martin even has us attacking each other, if and we don't drop anchor here and pay half a cargo to him.
Bloodstout, another female corsair, joined her companion.
Ripdog and Baronka are right. Ublaz is too greedy. He's got all the shipbuilding and repairing wood piled up back of his place. There ain't any good trees growing on the island no more. Last trip, my vessel run afoul of rocks, ripped part of the stern away. Sagatar and Lask took all my cargo and payment for timber to fix her up again. We should get wood free whenever we needs it.
Bilgetail nodded, moving decisively to Baronka's side.
I'll join you. Mad Eyes has grown too powerful. He executed 2 of my crew for arguing with those monitors over booty. Just had 'em dragged off and slain. You all remember it.
Heads nodded around the table. Baronka stove in the top of a cask with his saber handle.
Dip your beakers into this here seaweed grog, and drink if you're with me, mates. Any beast that don't dip a beaker is against us.
The pact for rebellion was sealed, as every beaker dipped into the cask. Ublaz stood watching the ship freebooter from the high window slit of an antechamber. Sagatar waited apprehensively at the Pine Martin's side. After a while, the Emperor turned to his chief trident rat.
Slashback, Flaney, Rockpaw, all the captains are aboard Baronka's ship.
What would you say they are doing, Sagatar?
The trident rat chose her words carefully.
Mightiness,
who knows what is in the minds of wave vermin?
The silver dagger blade tapped gently against Sagatar's tunic.
I do. Ublaz knows all. That is why I am emperor. They are plotting against me. They think I am weak without Lask Frildor. But we will show them, won't we, my strong right paw?
The trident rat bobbed her head respectfully. As you say, Excellency, I am yours to command.
The Pine Marten tapped the dagger blade against his sharp white teeth a moment before giving further orders.
Take all your trident rats, fully armed, quickly now, and block off the end of the jetty. Do not attack, but don't let any of the captains pass. Keep them aboard the ship, and await my command.
Sagatar went swiftly off to carry out orders. Ublaz motioned to a monitor guard.
Assemble all my monitors in the courtyard, and bring the prisoner Kanva here to me.
Grath Longfletch, a daughter of Holt Lutra, should have been dead 2 seasons ago. She had been found 3 nights after Kanva's attack on her family home, crawling through the mud of a half-dried stream with horrific injuries. Glink, the water vole, and his wife Sitch dragged Grath between them to an overhang in a mossy bank close to their den. As best they could, the voles tended the otter, but there was little the pair could do save give her some hot soup and cover her with dry bracken. Grath lay all season long at the very entrance to death's door, some hidden inner flame keeping her alive, reliving in nightmares with loud cries the horrors she had survived. Gradually she recovered and spent her days eating and sleeping, growing slowly in strength and agility. At her request, Glink brought a long, sturdy yew branch to Grath. With a flint shard, the otter scraped and fashioned it, wetting and steaming the wood over a fire. She strung it with flaxen threads, twined and greased by beeswax. Then, one by one, she made her arrows of ashwood, each as straight as a die, feathered with the green plumage of a lapwing Sitch had found dead upon the shore. Then, early one spring morn, Grath rose wordlessly and strode off along the stream shallows. Glink and Sitch followed the silent otter, watching her intently. Except for Grath's request for the yew branch, she had never spoken to them, nor them to her. Glink and his wife seldom spoke to one another. Some bank voles are like that. Near the northern shore, both voles sat on a stream bank, where it broadened to meet the estuary. On the opposite bank, Grath was a long time out of sight, inside the holt of her father Lutra. Emerging stone-faced and still silent, Grath set aside her weapons and went to work. Gathering twigs, root branches, and stones, she piled them up over the holt entrance. She carried mud from the riverbank and plastered it over the doorway, mixing it with grass and leaves. It took her a full day and most of the night to seal up the humble cavern, making it a tomb for her massacred family. Afterward, Grath washed herself in the stream. Silvery scar traces showed through her wet fur. Then, standing motionless in the water, she watched the gentle spring dawn spread its light across the skies, blinking as she shed tears for her kin. Gathering her great bow and the quiverful of green-feathered shafts, Grath Longfletch waded to the far bank and took hold of the two bank voles' paws.
"Friends, I know not your names, but I thank ye both for taking care of me and saving my life. I won't be back this way, so fortune care for ye both. Farewell."
Grath shouldered her quiver and bow, then turning west, she set off at an easy lope towards the dunes along the shore. Both water voles stared at the back of the long figure until it was lost to view. Then Glink spoke to his wife.
"I would not like to be one of the beasts that slew her kin. That creature carries death in her paws."
4. Extract from the Journal of Rollo Bankvole, Recorder of Redwall Abbey in Mossflower Country. Spring weather can change suddenly as the mind of an old mousewife choosing mushrooms. Deary me, how it can make the most carefully laid plans go astray. This very morning the weather was so soft and fair that Abbot Dorrel decided to hold our first spring season feast out of doors. Poor Dorrel. He spent most of the night in the kitchens cooking and baking with his friend Higgle Stump. Strange, is it not? Higgle was one of the wine-cellar keepers of the family Stump. Yet he wound up as Redwall's kitchen friar. And Dural was once a lowly kitchen mouse, but now he is Father Abbot of all Redwall. He is such a humble old fellow. His love of the kitchens never left him.
Ah me!
Seasons roll upon seasons, and yet our abbey remains the same, a loving old place, filled with happiness and peace, even though our old friends are but memories to us now. We who were once young are now grayed with age. Orlando the Axe, our great badger lord,
roamed off long ago, as male badgers will, to end his seasons at Salamandastron, mountain stronghold of great badger warriors. I do not know if he still lives. Alma, his daughter, is now the Abbey mother. Badgers are indeed noble creatures, with a lifespan which no beast can equal. So that only leaves two, Alma and myself, Rollo Backbull, who have lived and prospered in bygone seasons. The others have gone to their well-deserved rest, including Matameo and Tess Churchmouse, whose son Martin is now our Abbey warrior. Peacefully they went in the certainty that the wisdom and knowledge they gave to this great abbey is still held strong in the stone of Redwall and in the minds of its creatures who carry on the wonderful tradition. Great seasons, how I do wander off! I should have been called Rollo of the Roving Quillpen. Where was I? Oh, yes, I was telling you of the outdoor feast our abbot had planned. Well, needless to say, as soon as a few tables were carried out to the orchard and some benches to sit upon, swoosh, down came the rain. However, I must own up to the fact that I was not totally unhappy. The great hall inside our abbey is a comfortable place for feasting. Far better for my creaky bones than a draughty orchard in early spring. Poor Mole, the leader of our abbey moles, has convinced the abbot to commence festivities late this afternoon. This will give Formole and his crew time to create a huge turnip and tater and beetroot pie, a most homely delicacy. Actually, I think my paw rheumatism is playing me up a bit, so here I'll end my daily recording and pop off over to the kitchens, where I can savor the sights and smells of the good food. Not that I'm a greedy creature, you understand, merely appreciative, and slightly peckish, too. My warm old cloak will give me sound protection in this awful rainstorm. The walk from gatehouse to abbey seems to get longer as I get older. Rollo the recorder donned his cloak and stirred the fat otter curled in slumber on the hearth mat by the gatehouse fire. Wolger, come on, matey, wakey, wakey. Let's pay the kitchens a visit and see how the feast preparations are progressing. Wolger yawned, stretched and blinked in one movement. Then, scratching his rudder-like tail, he stood up. "Wakey, wakey yourself, Rollo. I wasn't asleep, just closing me eyes, 'cause your scratchy pen was annoying me. Ah, look at yourself. You got more skins on than an onion.' The Bankvole sniffed airily. "Young snip, you'll learn as you get older that comfort outweighs fashion. I need to wrap up warm until 'tis early summer." The two friends bent their heads against the wind and rain as they left the gatehouse, still keeping up a friendly banter. "Listen, you need all that rapping, matey. Stops your blowing off like an old autumn leaf. Know your trouble, fatty tail. No respect for your elders. It makes me shiver just looking at you, trolling round wearing little else but belt and tunic. Gah! Fresh air and a spot of rain never hurted any beast. Come on, wrinkled chops, step out smart-like." The kitchens were a bustle of steam, noise, and merriment. Teasel, the hogwife of Higgle's Stump, was crimping the edges of an apple and damson pie prior to putting it in the oven. She was about to open the oven door when a little mole maid called Diggum bumped into the back of her with a flour trolley. Teasel fell backward with a whoop, holding the pie, and landed on top of the trolley. Diggum shot off regardless, head down, pushing the trolley at full speed. Formole saw them coming, swiftly threw down a barrel wedge, and flung wide the oven door where his deeper-never pie was cooking. The trolley stopped with a jerk. Formole grabbed the back of Teasel's apron as she let go of the pie, and it shot from her paws to land neatly in the oven alongside Formole's creation. He grinned and nodded at her, rumbling in the curious mole speech, "There you go, Marm. Bain't no sense in wastin' oven spice, har-har." Diggum dusted flour from her smock and blinked. "Thank ye, Zur. Can I use e other oven for moi chessberry flan?" Formole raised a cloud of flour as he patted her dusty head. "Why, serpently e can, e little missy. But what be chessberries?" Diggum twitched her button nose in despair at Formole's ignorance. "Why, chestnutters and blackberries, Zur,
What else?
Teasel the hogwife hid a smile as she took Diggum's paw, saying, Chestnuts and blackberries indeed. Come on, we'll make it together. I'll roll the pastry.
Diggum curtsied prettily.
Thank ye, Morm, and oil eat any blackberries what be a wrong size.
Friar Higgle's Stump was topping off a multicolored woodland trifle with yellow meadow cream, roaring orders all about as he did.
Hoy, Picknum, see that mushroom soup don't boil. Keep stirring it.
Stirring hard as I can, Friar. Shall I throw chopped carrot in?
Aye, do that, missy.
Gerbil, be a good mole. Nip down to the cellars and see if my brother Furlow has broached a new barrel of October ale. Tell him I could do with a beaker to liven up my dark fruitcake mixture.
Right ho, Zor. Though you'm sure it ain't to liven up yourself.
Get going, you cheeky wretch.
Cracklin', see if you can get some of that dried mint down off the rafter hooks. I need to make tea.
The squirrel Cracklin' shot off like a rocket. She bounced from a stovetop to a high cupboard and leapt up to the rafter hooks, skillfully plucking a bundle of dried mint. Cutting a somersault, she landed next to Friar Higgle, dropped the mint in his paws, scooped a blob of meadow cream from the mixing bowl, and vaulted off, licking her paw.
Abbot Durrell watched her admiringly as he carried a deep dish to place in front of Higgle.
What an acrobat our Cracklin' is, eh, Friar?
Taste that and tell me what you think, my old friend. With a knife tip, Higgle sampled a morsel from the dish edge.
Mmm, now that is what I call a real honey rhubarb crumble.
Durrell shuffled his footpaws in embarrassment at the praise given to his simple offering.
Oh, it's just something I made up from an old recipe. Shall we have the tables laid for around twilight? I've lit a good log fire in Great Hall. That'll warm it through nicely.
Higgle, topping his trifle, nodded agreement.
Good idea, Father Abbot.
Have you seen Martin about?
Abbot Durrell scratched his chin thoughtfully.
Can't say I have. Perhaps he's up in the infirmary with Sister Cicely. I'll go and take a look.
Wind and rain shook the treetops of Mossflower until they swayed and undulated madly. Howling gales sang a wild dirge between the weighty tree trunks. Paw and paw, fighting for breath, Tansy and Arvin staggered doggedly on towards the forest fringe. Both of them were weary and paw-sore, and, driven by fright, they had partially lost their way. Then Tansy spotted the tall spire of Redwall through a gap in the woodlands. Staggering, the pair ran, slopping through a narrow ditch, fighting against whippy spring brush and squelching through rain-drenched ferns. Heedless of young nettles lashing at their footpaws, they rounded a massive tree-topped oak, straight into the paws of a dark-cloaked form.
Yeek!
The baby squirrel and the young hedgehog maid squealed aloud in fright as they felt themselves held by strong paws.
Whoa now, my little ones. Here you are.
The strong, kindly face of Martin the Warrior of Redwall smiled reassuringly down at them. With a shriek of relief, Tansy and Arvin buried their faces in Martin's cloak. Perching Arvin on his shoulder and taking Tansy by the paw, Martin strode back toward the abbey.
"Sister Cicely was getting quite worried about you two," Martin said gently. "You should have been back at the abbey hours ago when the storm broke. Where in the name of seasons have you been? All muddy and scratched, with your clothes torn like that?"
Arvin was not afraid of anything now that Martin had found them. He had perked up considerably.
"Me found a scowling tongue in a rocks," he cried.
Martin chuckled.
"A scowling tongue?"
"In the sandstone rock, sir," Tansy explained. "Down a deep crack, there was a skeleton of some beast. Ugh, all white and bony and raggy."
Martin saw the young hogmaid was bone-weary. He let her lean against him and shielded her with his cloak.
"Well, you're safe now," he said. "You can tell the elders about it when we get back to the abbey. Oh, I forgot to tell you. There's to be a surprise spring feast in Great Hall this evening. How do you like that, eh, young'uns?"
But they were both dozing, almost asleep with fatigue. Sister Cicely put both Arvin and Tansy straight to bed when Martin delivered them back to her at the sick bay. They had been sound asleep before Martin arrived at the abbey gate. Spreading his cloak by the hearth to dry,
Martin accompanied Cicely downstairs, explaining as he went. "Something frightened them in the woodland today. I'll tell you about it when we're with the elders." No beast could be quite sure what made the spring feast such a success, the food or the fun. Martin and Cicely sat at the table with the abbot, Formol, Higgle, Alma, and some other elders. They watched in amusement as the younger ones sat with their food on a thick rush mat, eating and providing their own entertainment. The smallest abbey babes, the Dibbons, ate all in sight with growing appetites.
"Oi, Dor, Garfy, pass oi yon fruity cake. Yum can have some of this plum puddin'. 'Tis turrible tasty."
"Well, thank ye, my old moly mate. I didn't know it were you behind those cream whiskers."
"Father Habit, sir, would you like some of my strawberry roly-poly?"
Smiling, the abbot shook his head.
"No, thank you, Durgle. I baked that specially for you and Garfy. Besides, I'm enjoying my salad. Nothing like fresh spring salad after the winter. What do you say, Alma?"
The badger mother held up a piece of cheese in her huge paw.
"Aye, Durgle, and when there's soft white cheese and hot baked oat bread to go with it, well, I'm happy."
Martin looked up from a steaming mushroom and leek pasty.
"I've never seen you sad when there's food about, Alma."
Amid roars of laughter at her huge appetite, the badger winked at Martin.
"Well, sir, I'm only making up for all the food that you used to scoff from in front of me when you sat on my knee as a Dibbon."
Furlough Stump, the cellar-keeper, poured himself a beaker of October ale.
"Be you not careful, marm, and Martin'll sit on your knee again and scoff all that bread and cheese, I'll wager," he chortled.
Rollo put aside a platter which had contained chestnut and blackberry flan, and banged the table-top with a soup ladle.
"Come on, you young'uns, how's about a bit of song and dance for your poor elders before we fall asleep from boredom?"
In a flash, Picknum the mouse-maid and Cracklin the squirrel-maid were up and bowing to each other as they warbled an old ballad.
"Oh, look out, it's the terrible two,"
Sister Cicely murmured in Martin's ear. Picknum and Cracklin sang alternate verses at each other.
"As I strode out gaily one morning in spring, I spied a fair mouse-maid who happily did sing. She sang just as sweet as a lark's rising call, for she wore a green habit, and she came from Redwall. I walked alongside her and bade her good morn, and her smile was as pretty as rosebuds at dawn. She captured my heart, and she held it in thrall, for she wore a green habit, and she came from Redwall. I said, 'Lovely mouse-maid, where do you go to?' 'To Mossflower Wood, sir, for flowers of blue, to decorate my bonnet at the feast in Great Hall, for she wore a green habit, and she came from Redwall. To the woodlands we went, and 'twas there in a glade I gathered wild bluebells for my young mouse-maid. Then I walked her back home, lest she stumble or fall, for she wore a green habit, and she came from Redwall.' 'Pray, sir,' said the mouse-maid, 'be my gallant guest. Oh, how happy was I to take up her request, for I never will leave that old abbey at all. Now we both wear green habits, and we live at Redwall.'"
Picknum and Cracklin flounced about, grinning broadly and curtsying deeply at the cheers and applause they received. Alma chuckled, watching Mouse and Squirrel-maid milking the ovation for all it was worth.
"Those two, what a pair! Hi there, Gerbil! What about a reel?"
The little mole took up his drum and thrummed at it with his heavy digging claws, calling to Friar Higgle,
"Come on, Sir Eagle, out with the hog-twanger!"
The friar produced his hog-twanger, a curious three-stringed instrument which had belonged to his father, Jubilation Stump. Holding its strings down over his head, he began humming a tune and nodding oddly. As he did, his head-spike struck the strings in time to the nodding and humming. Hog-twangers can only be played by hedgehogs, and Friar Higgle Stump was an expert. Recognizing the lively reel, Abbey Babes and Dibbons sprang up and jigged about furiously, calling aloud,
"Frogs in a gully! Frogs in a gully!"
Alma sat watching, great footpads tapping, until she could restrain herself no longer. Then the big badger mother of Redwall lumbered out to join the dance, clapping her paws and whooping,
"Frogs in the gully! Frogs in the gully!"
Martin and the elders remained seated, helpless with laughter at the sight. Gerbil stepped up the drumbeat, and Higgle kept pace on his hog-twanger. Faster and faster they played. Hopping, skipping, and leaping, the dancers whirled, hallooing loudly. While Alma made her own hefty pace, exhausted Dibbons perched on both her footpaws and were bumped up and down. Then, dropping to all fours, Alma let the tiny creatures climb onto her broad back. When she was fully loaded, the crafty badger danced off in the direction of the dormitories, followed by Higgle and Gerbil, still playing as they shepherded the other young ones up to bed. Later, when she had rejoined the elders at table, Alma sat back and sighed wearily.
"Phew! I'm getting too old to do that much longer."
Martin patted her striped muzzle affectionately.
"You're a sly old fraud, Alma. You enjoy it more than the Dibbons."
He poured her a beaker of cold mint tea, his voice growing serious.
"Little Arvin and Tansy were in a dreadful state when I found them in Mossflower Wood today. Dirty, ragged, weary, and very frightened."
"Indeed they were," agreed Sister Cicely. "Both so exhausted they couldn't speak. I popped up to see them in the sick bay not an hour back. Fast asleep, the pair of them. Strange, though. Tansy is a proper little rock of good sense. Did she say what had frightened them, Martin?"
Martin looked around the expectant faces of the elders and said, "They found a dead creature in the woodlands."
"A dead creature in the woodlands?" Abbot Durrell repeated in hushed tones.
Questions followed from around the table.
"What sort of creature was it? Where did they find this creature? I wonder how it got there."
The warrior mouse held up a paw for silence. "Please, let me explain. This was not a recently dead beast. Tansy said it was a skeleton, clad in rotten rags. So evidently it had been there for some time. They came upon it down a crack in the sandstone rocks of the woodlands. I know the place well. Actually, they weren't far from the rocks when I found them, so they must have been running in circles since they were caught in the thunderstorm. Poor Tansy. She was terrified, but doing her level best to protect little Arvin and get him back to Redwall."
Formole nodded from behind a large beaker of October ale.
"Oh, aye. She'm a little good beast, all right.
Mayhap you'm goin' there on the morrow to see for eself, Zer Martin."
Martin pushed back his chair and stood up decisively. "Why leave it until tomorrow, friends? The night is fine now. I'll go and be back before dawn. No need to upset our abbey creatures by starting an expedition in full daylight. Besides, I can't sleep at all if there's anything bothering my mind, so it's best that I investigate it this very night. Aye, with me by your side, mate, soon as I finds me ash stave." No sooner had Walger, the other gatekeeper, spoken than the others were all including themselves.
"Her, I too. He may have need a good digger, Zur.
I'll bring a long stout rope from the wine cellar." "Right, and I'll fetch lanterns. We'll be in need of light."
Martin hesitated a moment, then nodded. "So be it. I'll get the sword. Meet back here as quickly as you can. Alma, will you stay behind and watch the main gate?"
"Gladly, friend. I don't feel much like charging around woodlands after our spring feast this evening."
5. The Redwaller set off north up the path, Martin in the lead, with the sword buckled about his middle. This was the fabulous blade that belonged long ago to Martin the First Warrior, he who had helped build Redwall Abbey and establish the Order of Redwallers. The spirit of this brave mouse was said to help the abbey creatures, appearing in dreams and offering wise counsel in troubled times. For countless generations the sword had been lost. It was Matthias, father of Matameo and grandsire of the present Martin, who had found the sword and restored it to Redwald Abbey. Silent as shadows, the little party slipped into the night-darkened trees. They were skilled in the ways of woodlanders, and knew that stealth and care, combined with speed, was the rule of safety, even in their own beloved Mossflower. There was no moon to light the way east, but Martin was an expert leader. Skirting thickets, bypassing brambles, and staying close to the deep shadows, he led his companions to the clearing where the sandstone rift could be seen, poking up at an angle out of the ground. Martin signaled quietly for Wulger and Formole to accompany him, indicating that the rest should stay in the tree shelter at the clearing's edge, ready to come running should they be needed. Drawing his sword, the warrior edged forward. The mole and otter followed, carrying rope and lantern. The rain had stopped, though a sighing wind was still blowing up from the south. Mounting the rocks, Martin waited whilst Formole put flint to tinder and lit his lantern. Shielding the light and the cowl of his cloak, Martin led his friends across the ridged surface. As they came upon each cleft, the lantern was lowered down on the rope to explore its darkness. They had nearly covered half the area when Formole, shuffling backward away from a small fissure, disappeared with a gruff bass yelp.
Vroom!
The lantern was swiftly lowered as Wolger called down to him.
You all right, matey?
Not hurted, are you?
Wiping his paw disgustedly upon his smock, the good mole wrinkled his snout.
Yer he is, sir. I finded e skeleton. Yerk.
Martin dropped swiftly into the crevice, landing lightly beside Formole. He held the lantern close, illuminating the gleaming white bones that poked through rain-sodden rags. Wolger peered down at the skull, fixed in its death grin. Poor wretch. Fancy dying down here all alone. There was compassion in the otter's tone. Martin knelt and retrieved something from the fleshless claw of what had once been the creature's right front paw.
Aye, poor beast. What was it that brought him here?
A low whistle from the tree fringe caused Wolger to throw himself flat upon the rocks.
Hearken, and hide that lamp glim. We've got visitors.
Swiftly, Martin pulled off his cloak and gave it to Formole.
Stay down here. Keep that light covered. Hang on to the rope, Wolger. I'm coming up.
Sheathing his sword, the warrior mouse clambered paw over paw up the rope, with Wolger taking the strain.
Remain here with Formole. Stay low,
Martin whispered. Wraith-like, Martin appeared beside Rollo, among the trees. The recorder squeaked with fright.
Ooh, don't sneak up on me like that.
The abbot pointed a paw north into the dark tree masses. Over yonder, Martin. I thought I heard voices, and saw two white shapes. See, there they go. They caught a fleeting glimpse of whitish forms moving among the trees. Martin nudged Higgle's stump, saying,
Bring the ash stave and follow me, friar.
Crouching low, they threaded off, carefully avoiding dry twigs beneath the tree cover. Judging the path the intruders were taking, Martin halted between a beech and an elm, signaling his intentions to Higgle. Martin crouched behind the beech and grasped one end of the stave. The friar stooped behind the elm and took the other end. The warrior mouse whispered across to his companion.
They're coming this way. Hold the stave low until I give the signal.
As the shapes drew closer, voices could be heard.
There's nothing dark as the dark, me old mother used to say.
Really? Well, that was jolly observant of her, what? I'll wager she used to go on about how flippin' light the day was. Oh, whoop!
Martin and Higgle had raised the stave a fraction so that the speaker tripped, sprawling flat in front of them. Immediately Martin saw that the other shape was some type of great bird. Snatching Higgle's cloak, he flung it over the creature, bringing it to the ground. The others dashed across and flung themselves upon the beast, who had tripped, trying to pin it down as it yelled and kicked wildly.
Ambush, chaps! Bring up the regiment! Tell mother I died fightin'!
Martin bounced along the ground, towed by the cloaked bird. Then he banged into a tree and was forced to let go. Recognizing the other creature's voice, he dashed back to his companions, yelling,
It's all right, release him! It's a hare!
The hare, whose long legs had kicked most of them flying, leapt up indignantly, dusting himself down and muttering,
"'Flamin' cheek! Of course I'm a hare! What do you think I was, a long-legged tadpole out for a bloomin' walk?'
Rushing irately past Martin, he uncovered his traveling companion, a great barn owl, all ruffled and blinking furiously. The hare was half-white, a mountain hare patching into his brown spring coat. Striking a heroic fighting pose, he challenged them.
Blackguards, ruffians, attacking poor wayfarers, eh? Well, let me tell you, blatherpawed bandits, you've picked on the wrong pair this time. Right. Defend yourselves sharpish now. I'd teach you a thing or three about the jolly old noble art, what? Come on!
Prancing about in the most ridiculous manner, he blew fiercely through his whiskers, wobbling, ducking, and flicking his paw against the side of his nose in a businesslike manner.
Come on, come on, shape up! You cowardly custards! Oh, mattress bottom, you take those six and I'll deal with the other ten.
The hare twirled and weaved comically, throwing punches in midair, until by accident his nose collided with an overhanging branch. Immediately he went into a mock state of collapse, staggering, throwing his paws wide as if appealing to a referee.
"Did you see that? Beastly foul play, sir. Low underpawed trickery. Sneaking up on a chap like that. Highly unprincipled. Deduct 10 points. 10 points, I say, sir."
He stopped and turned to the owl, who was unruffling his feathers and still blinking furiously.
"Well, you're a great help, I must say. Foozlin' great flock-filled featherbag. Don't stand there blinking like a toad with a toothache. Assist me against these vile villains."
Trying his level best not to burst out laughing, Martin held forth the paw of friendship.
"I'm sorry. Please accept our apologies, sir, and your friend, too. We thought you were the villains, but as it turns out, neither of us is. However, I'm sure that you'll agree with me. No beast can be too careful abroad in woodlands on a moonless night."
Immediately the hare's attitude changed. He shook Martin's paw, chuckling as he bowed to the other Redwallers.
"Friends, eh? Well, I knew that all along, just testing, what? Allow me to introduce myself, ahem. I'm Clickstar Lippus Montissel, of the far northern Montissels, that is, known to all and sundry as Clecky. My erstwhile companion of the road you may call Garrel. Simple to remember, you see, Clecky and Garrel. As you may have probably observed, Garrel is an owl, though not of the wise old variety, more the silly young type, I'd say. Bit of a duffer, what?"
Garrel blinked his great eyes at the assembly, saying,
"Ah, well, 'tis nice to see you, sir, so 'tis. A rare old pleasure."
Clecky shook his head despairingly.
"Would some beast put the cloak back over his puddin'-head? We were getting more sense out of the bird when he was silent. Oh, I say, look, there's a small fat mouse on fire."
Formole and Walger had joined them, Formole holding the lantern. He tugged his nose in greeting to the hare, saying,
"Hur-hur, you and be a girt jokers, or I bain't no mouse afire. I am naught but a mole with a lantern."
General good humor prevailed, and amid introductions all round, the two wayfarers were invited back to Redwall. The little party proceeded to the abbey with Formole in the lead, carrying his lantern. Martin and the abbot brought up the rear. Abbot Durrell had retrieved Tansy's basket. He checked the contents, saying,
"Old hogweed stalks? Young Angelica?
See, she even managed to find some new-grown wintergreen.
What a dutiful creature little Tansy is. A pity she was frightened by the sight of a dead beast. Did you recognize anything about its remains, Martin?"
The warrior mouse drew his cloak close against the night wind.
"Very little. Apart from the fact that he was a weasel once. Some kind of corsair, too, if the rags he had on were anything to go by. Strange, though, he was clasping this in his paw. Firmald spoon. That weasel must have been inside our abbey."
The spoon was old, beautifully carved from the wood of a buckthorn bush. Martin passed it to the abbot, who also recognized it.
"You're right. This was the spoon Firmald the Ancient used to carry about with her."
"Aha! Now I know. The creature you found was Greylunk, the weasel. He came to us 2 autumns ago."
Martin rubbed his chin, obviously puzzled.
2 autumns back? Why didn't I see this Greylunk?"
The father abbot paused, then held up his paw.
"Of course you wouldn't know. That was the season you spent away from Redwall, helping the Gwasom shrews against robber foxes."
Upon reaching the abbey, most of the elders sought their beds. Martin, Rollo, and the abbot busied themselves adding logs to the fire in Great Hall and putting together a sizable repast from the remains of the spring feast for the owl and hare. Clecky poured himself a beaker of strawberry cordial, heaped a platter high with deeper than ever turnip and tater and beetroot pie, topped it off with 2 wedges of cheese and a massive portion of fresh spring salad, and wiped away a tear of joy with the corner of his white tunic.
"Oh, Corks! I say, you chaps, what a spiff and spread! Tell me I'm not dreaming, what?"
Garrel, the young barn owl, speared a carrot and mushroom plan with his powerful talons.
"Ara, away with ya, flop ears! No beast could imagine you a-dreamin' with vittles in front of you great long-legged gut-bag.
Why, I've seen turnips uproot themselves and run from you, with my own two eyes, so I have.
Seated by the fire with Rollo and the abbot, Martin smiled as he watched the two ravenous newcomers.
Friar Higgle won't need any leftover recipes with those gluttons about.
Right. Tell me all you know about the weasel who visited here in my absence, Rollo. Using his journal as a reminder, Rollo the recorder related the incident. A weasel called Greylunk came to our abbey gates in mid-autumn. He was a villainous-looking vermin, but quite harmless due to a dreadful skull wound he had received, probably from one of his own kind. Greylunk was weak and ill, and not in his right mind. We took him in out of pity, gave him food, warmth, and shelter, doing what we could for his injury. I recall that he seemed to be terrified of many things, from the merest shadow to the sight of a bird flying overhead.
He would often be found crouched in a corner, moaning things like,
"Mad eyes will find me, his claws stretch beyond sea and land. Fools that we were to take the tears of all oceans, death follows wherever they go. Witless beast that I am, woe to me, 'tis useless to try to escape the vengeance of mad eyes." Here Martin interrupted. "Hmm, very strange. It may be nonsense, but on the other hand it may not. Tears of all oceans. Mad eyes. Claws stretching beyond sea and land? Sounds like a riddle to me.
As if this Mad Eyes is after those tears, whatever they are. And why was Greylunk out there with Fermal's spoon?"
"I remember that dirge, too," said the abbot. "The weasel carried on moaning and whining in such a manner, until even the most patient abbey beast grew tired of his ceaseless dirge. There was only one who had any sympathy for Greylunk, and that was Fermald the Ancient." Martin polished the buckthorn spoon fondly with his sleeve. "Ah, yes, poor old Fermald. May fates rest kindly upon her. What an odd little squirrel. Always saying verse and talking in riddles. I've heard it said that overlong seasons may sometimes do that to a creature. Fermald retreated into the curious world her mind had created. Maybe it was a nice place for her to be. She was always smiling and contented. She lived alone in the attics, above the dormitories. Perhaps the answer to this mystery lies somewhere there. Oh, I'm sorry, Rollo, please carry on." The recorder put aside his journal, shrugging. "There's not much more to tell. Fermal took Greylunk up to her attic. They ate, talked, and slept there. Hardly any beast in Redwall recalled seeing the weasel for 6 or 7 days. Then one morning Fermald came to the kitchens for food, and took only sufficient for one." Again the abbot recalled the incident. "Ah, yes, excuse me, Rollo. I was there that day helping Higgle to make an upside-down cake. So I asked Fermald why she was not taking food for her guest, and she replied just one word. Gone. Remembering the deep skull wound Greylunk had, I asked her if he were dead and gone. Her answer was very cryptic." Martin leaned forward in his chair, saying, "Do you recall what she said, Father Abbot?" Durrell sat back, folding both paws into his wide sleeve and closing his eyes. "Indeed I do," he said. "Fermald spoke in rhyme. The line stuck in my mind for no good reason. Dead and gone? No, gone to be dead. Following the crack that runs through his head. From beyond the sunset they will appear. Tell them the weasel was never here. Remember my words and use them some day to keep the wrath of Mad Eyes away." In the silence that followed, there was a noise from the far corner by the stairs. Swiftly Martin held a paw to his lips and moved quietly across Great Hall, followed by Rollo. They were almost halfway to the source of the noise when Clecky went dashing past them, paws slapping noisily on the stone-paved floor. Reaching the stair bottom, he held up two pieces of a pottery platter. "Plate fell down the stairs, what? That's all the noise was," he chortled. "Us hares don't miss a bally thing, even when we're scoffin'. I say, you chaps were a bit tardy there, tip-pawing about like shrimps in a swamp, what? Martin went straight up the stairs at a run, while Rollo stood glaring frostily at the hare, exclaiming between gritted teeth, "Thank you very much, sir, for frightening away whoever was on those stairs listening to our conversation.
Your great lolloping footpaws sent them off upstairs before we had a chance to see who it was.
The mountain hare wiggled his long ears huffily.
Tut, tut, sir. If you'd been a touch quicker, like I was, then you'd have the culprit by the jolly old heels.
Rollo clenched his paws tightly in frustration.
But you didn't get the culprit by the jolly old heels, did you?
No, you ruined our chance to catch the eavesdropper quietly. Clucky smiled disarmingly at the irate recorder.
No cause to get upset, old feller. We all make mistakes. Perhaps next time you'll take my advice and nip along smart-like, eh?
Then the outrageous hare went speedily back to his table, berating his dining partner.
I say there, Shovelbeak, go easy on that woodland trifle. I've only had 2 portions yet.
Think of others beside yourself, you great feathered famine-fetcher.
Martin came back down the stairs, shaking his head at Rollo and the abbot.
Couldn't see any beast about up there. The young'uns are fast asleep and snoring. One of them may have left the plate on the stairs at bedtime. Maybe it was balancing on a stair edge, and it only took a slight draft to topple it.
Gerald the barn owl wiped meadow cream from his beak with a wingtip.
Arr, that's what myself thinks has happened, Your Honor. Sure a good puff of wind can blow even an owl tip over tail if the creature's not stood up properly. And that's a fact, so 'tis.
Abbot Durrell put his paws about the shoulders of Martin and Rollo.
Perhaps friend Gerald is right. Now what we need is a nice gentle breeze to waft us upstairs. Time for sleep, I think.
Martin fought back a yawn.
Good idea, Father Abbot, he agreed. We'll talk more tomorrow over breakfast.
He looked at the 2 visitors.
When you 2 have finished eating, perhaps you wouldn't mind sleeping on that rush mat by the fire for tonight. I'll have Brother Dormal fix proper accommodation for you tomorrow.
The owl waved a soup ladle at the retreating trio.
I thank you kindly, sirs. The mat'll be fine for the likes of us.
Clecky put aside the trifle bowl he had been licking clean.
The likes of us, indeed. Speak for yourself, Cushion Bottom. I'm putting me paws up in that big abbot's chair yonder. Likes of us. Blinkin' drafty barn is all you're used to. Aye, and that's the truth, so 'tis. Me old mother used to say, better to be an owl in a barn than a prince in a palace. So she did.
And what, pray, did your old mother mean by that?
Sure, how would I be knowin'? Sounds grand, though, doesn't it? Oh, go and boil your fat head. Good night.
The abbey was quiet and still as the fires burned low. Outside, chill winds sighed and whined against red walls and movable stone. Though it was less than 4 hours to dawn, Martin lay awake, his mind picking over that evening's events. Greylunk's skeleton and the rocky fissure, Fermal's spoon, the ancient's rhyme, an unknown creature called Mad Eyes, and the mysterious eavesdropper who had listened to the conversation in Great Hall. What did it all mean? 6. Conva, the corsair, had spent a perilous night in the monitor barracks, huddled in a corner, shivering and hungry. The long-tongued lizards constantly watched him, their flat reptilian eyes appraising his trembling form. He did not know whether to feel fear or relief when 2 of them entered the barracks and hauled him off for an audience with the Emperor. He was ushered into an upper room. The pine marten lounged on the sill of a broad window, open to the warm tropical noontide. Behind Ublaz, 4 great black-backed gulls perched on the window ledge. They were fearsome-looking birds, each with the characteristic red spot of their species adorning the tip of its heavy amber bill. Mad-Eye's cruelty was legendary. Conva went rigid with terror, and his footpaws scrabbled against the floor as he resisted the monitors dragging him into the room. Ublaz was in no mood to be delayed. Fixing the corsair with a stare of icy contempt, he rapped harshly.
"Cease struggling, idiot. If I wanted you dead, you'd have been crab meat yesterday. Sit at that table and do as I command."
Quickly Conva seated himself. Ublaz leaned over, his silver dagger blade tapping a bark parchment and charcoal sticks, which lay on the table in front of the corsair.
"You saw the 6 pearls, did you not? Felt them? Noted their shape? Held the shell in which they were kept?" he snapped.
Conva nodded.
"Aye, mightiness.
The dagger blade tapped the corsair's paw lightly. Good. Then you can draw them for me, the pearls and the shell. Kondva picked up a charcoal stick hesitantly.
But I don't know if I'm any good at drawing, sire.
Lifting Kondva's chin with the blade, Ublaz said gently, warningly,
Perhaps you didn't hear me right, sea scum. I said draw. If you wish to continue living...
Hastily, Kondva began sketching, answering the Emperor's questions, as his paw guided the slim charcoal stick.
None of the pearls was flawed or marked in any way?
No, sire. All six were perfect, smooth and round.
Were they of different sizes, some smaller than others?
Each was exactly the same size, sire, bigger than any pearls I have ever seen. Something like this. As Kondva outlined the six orbs, Ublaz watched approvingly, saying,
See, you can sketch.
Now the color of these beauties. Mightiness, they were a pale pink, not bright. In daylight they appeared soft and creamy, but by lantern light the pink showed warmer, like a budding rose.
Very poetic, my friend. You are doing well. Tell me about the scallop shell they were kept in.
It was a big deep-sea thing, sire. Both sides well-ridged and whitish-yellow. Some skilled beast had given it hinges, and a clasp carved from hardwood. Inside the shell was lined with soft red cloth. There were six cup-like dents to hold the pearls. As I recall, it looked like this. When the corsair had finished sketching, Ublaz took the parchment. After inspecting the drawing, he placed it in front of the four gulls on the window ledge. They gazed unblinkingly at the work. Ublaz stared into the eyes of Grawl, the leader of the black-backed gulls, concentrating all his mesmeric powers upon the huge bird. In a short time, Grawl was completely under the influence of the mad eyes and sinister voice.
Fly east to the shores of Mossflower Land, and find the place called Redwall. Stay there and watch. Should you see the pearls or the case, seize them and bring them here to me. If you cannot do this, then stop in the area, and wait until you sight Lask Frildur and those under his command. If they find the pearls, give this token to him.
Ublaz took a paw ring surmounted by a polished jetstone and looped it on a thong around Grawl's neck.
My monitor general will know this comes from me. Get the pearls from him, and fly back here to Sampetra. Go now. Ride the winds. Make your wings fly faster than the waves of the sea. When you return, I will reward you and your kin. Fly.
Kri-har-ka!
With a long wailing cry, the gulls took to the air, swooping off over the main, eastward. The pine marten smoothed his creamy throat fur, gazing at his reflection in a burnished bronze wall mirror. He turned to Kondva, who sat trembling at the table.
"And you, my friend," he said, "what shall I do with you?"
The charcoal stick crumbled in the corsair's shaking paw as he tried to tear his gaze from the pine marten's frightening eyes.
"Mighty one, let me live,"
he whimpered. Ublaz gripped Kondva tightly by his ears and stared down at him.
"A simple request, but one I am unwilling to grant. You have seen and heard too much, Kondva, far too much.
Look into my eyes." Slashback, the sea-rat captain, heard the clatter of paws and trident butts upon the jetty. He inched open the cabin door and peered out.
"Rats! Trident rats!" he yelled. "The jetty's crowded with them! We're trapped aboard this boat, mates!"
Baraka grabbed his sword and made for the door, snarling.
"We'll see how they likes the taste of cold steel, eh, mates?"
Slashback slammed the door shut.
"Stay your paw, or you'll get us all carved up. There's too many of them. We'd be fish bait before we got halfway along the jetty."
The stout captain Rockpaw slumped down and refilled his beaker.
"Ha! This is a great start to an uprising. Us trapped aboard ship, and our crews all ashore separated from their captains. Now's the time for bright ideas. Any beast got one?"
Slashback had cracked open the door again to watch what was going on outside.
"Well, they ain't made a move yet, just standing there. And Sagatar looking well pleased with herself," he said. "Ahoy! Here comes old Mad-Eyes himself with a gang of his monitors.
Baranka still had his saber at the ready.
Let's sit tight here and hear what Ublas has to say. I ain't going out there for a staring match with that one.
There was a pause in the proceedings. Then the sound of the Emperor's voice reached the rebels in the cabin.
Friends, brethren of the seas, have you got grievances? Come out here and tell them to me.
Baranka half opened the cabin door and shouted back,
Oh, we got grievances all right, but we ain't stupid. We can state them comfortable from here. We ain't taking no more orders from you, Ublas. Our crews outnumber you and your gang. Be reasonable, friends. Fighting will get us nowhere,
Ublas replied, signaling Sagatar to start the trident rats moving further up the jetty towards the ship.
Come up to my place. I will lay on a feast while we talk things out.
Suddenly Baranka burst out onto the deck, waving his saber and yelling,
Ahoy the taverns! Corsairs ahoy!
The bold move was successful. In an instant, sea rats and corsairs began piling out of the waterfront dens adjacent to the jetty. Ublas turned, pointing his silver dagger at them.
Stay back, keep out of this. It concerns only me, Ublas, and those aboard the freebooter.
Bilgetail, the weasel captain, came out on deck, followed by the other captains.
In a booming voice, the tall, somber weasel called to the crews,
Stand by to rush 'em, buckos. If they puts a single paw to this deck, then charge.
Baranka and Rockpaw had positioned themselves fore and aft. They stood by the head and stern mooring ropes, swords drawn. Baranka knew that Ublas had lost the element of surprise, but he had also figured that if the vermin crews charged, they could be easily fended off by trident rats defending the narrow jetty. Moreover, if an attack were mounted, Ublas and the front ranks of monitors and trident rats would swarm aboard and slaughter the captains before the crews could get to them. Baranka's brain was as nimble as his paws. Keeping his face averted from Ublas, he called out his demands.
Order your soldiers not to make any sudden moves, and we'll tell our crews to do likewise. But we're finished paying tribute to you, Ublas. As for the timber stocks you're holding, share 'em out atwixt the captains. Oh, and you can release my brother Conva now. Your days of imprisoning us is over.
A cold fury gripped the Emperor. He pointed his dagger at Baranka, snarling,
This is my island. I alone rule here. I am Emperor Ublas, and none dare look at my eyes. Sea scum, do not dictate terms to me, Baranka. Ask your brother. He is an even bigger fool than you.
Ublas signaled to his monitors. Four of the lizards strode forward with a sailcloth-wrapped bundle and slammed it down on the jetty. The bundle burst open, revealing the mangled carcass of Conva. End of Side 1. To continue, turn the cassette over.